From the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies, this is Pardes from Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, Pardes alum. This week, Tzria Metzora. This is a double parsha here in Israel for this week, because starting this week, we are out of sync with everyone outside of Israel in terms of the parsha schedule. That's because outside of Israel, Pesach is 8 days, and here it's 7 days. So the parsha schedule will be off by 1 week, with Israel ahead, up until the end of the Book of Vayikra in a couple of weeks, May 12th, at which point outside of Israel, folks will catch up by having a double parsha, while in Israel it'll be a single parsha, B'chutz L'tai, for the end of the Book of Vayikra. And then we'll all be in sync for the Book of Bamidbar. This week, Rabbi Alex Israel delivers the parsha podcast. Rabbi Alex Israel is a member of the Pardes faculty. And now, Rabbi Alex Israel.
Thank you, Larry. This week we're going to read a double parsha, the parsha of Tzria Metzora. And we're going to cover a range of different themes in this parsha, but each of them are linked by a common thread, and that is the thread of Tuma and Tahara, ritual purity and impurity. Now sometimes in our world, purity is associated with good, and impurity is associated with bad. And when we look at our parsha, this becomes incredibly problematic. And let me explain why. Let's do a little survey of the chapters of our double parsha, and we will see that maybe some of these we do see as bad, but some of the things the Torah calls tamei, impure, are actually very, very good. And that's how we start the parsha. We start with Tumat Hayoledet, the impurity or the defilement which is contracted by a woman who gives birth to a child, a male or female child. And we start off with saying, when a woman at childbirth bears a male, she shall be unclean for 7 days. If she bears a female, she should be unclean for double that time, 14 days. And talks about how to get back to a state of purity. I think we all think that childbirth is a wonderful miracle, the birth of a new life, the birth of a child. Why should childbirth contract a state of impurity? Is childbirth bad? Seems very difficult to accept that notion. But let's continue surveying our parsha. Chapter 12, as we say, deals with the impurity of childbirth. Chapter 13 and 14 deal with tzarat, some mysterious illness sometimes translated as leprosy, even though it doesn't seem like it's the medical leprosy that we know, where the skin or the hair of a person, or even a person's clothing, or the walls of their home, start turning different colors and become some way contaminated. And the Torah talks about the impurity which is contracted, the tumah which is contracted by tzara'at, by this mysterious state of things, the diagnosis which will be made by the priest, and the ways to heal this particular situation, whether it's on the skin, by waiting and waiting outside the camp, whether it's on clothing, where the particular area is cut out, or sometimes the garment is burnt, and likewise with a home, where the area which is contaminated on the wall will be somehow demolished. We move on from there to a chapter 15, not the funnest chapter to read, which deals with bodily discharges. A male discharge, where a man discharges certain fluids from his body, either in a unnatural way or a natural way, where a woman also can have a discharge which is natural when she gets her period, or at another time when it is not when she's expecting her period. And again, in all these situations, there is a process of purification. And the famous area in of this halacha is definitely going to be status of nida, the status that a woman contracts when she gets her period, and the purification by going to the mikvah. And again, I return back to my central question. Here we see a collection of laws which all relate to various bodily states, a whole range from childbirth to tzara'at, as again, sometimes called leprosy, but it really doesn't match the medical definition, to all sorts of discharges which come from the body. What do these all have in common? I'll even go back to chapter 11, the end of last week's parsha, which deals with clean and unclean animals, or maybe animals we can eat and animals we can't eat, but just because we can't eat an animal, does that make it unclean? If I can't eat, is a horse somehow less clean than a cow is clean? I don't know. I don't know how to distinguish between them, but one is kosher and one is not. And the Torah seems to relate to this issue with laws of Tumah and Tahara, ritual, cleanliness or purity and impurity. How exactly should we relate to all of this? I have to say that some, recently I read a book by Jonathan Haidt, some of you might have read it, The Righteous Mind, where he even talks about the way that Leviticus maybe sees things as unclean when they disgust a certain group or disgust a certain sect or religion. And then this is all about revulsion, disgust, distaste, things which are more distasteful and less distasteful, where there are societies which found, and our society amongst them, found certain animals distasteful, childbirth, decay of the flesh, certain bodily emissions as distasteful. I don't know. But I want to offer two theories in our time together, which each, I think, have some very interesting meaning behind them, and some very different understanding. I'm going to start off with a fascinating explanation by Rabbi Soloveitchik in his book Halachic Man. And Rabbi Soloveitchik suggests that in some way, everything that we're dealing with here, all of the sources of impurity, relate in some way to death. You'll say, but the first is childbirth. Childbirth is the beginning of life, not death. However, one could say, and this is an explanation, it might be a little bit forced, that from the perspective of this baby achieves life, but from the perspective of this woman, first, in childbirth, a woman is close to death, but second of all, she loses the life which is within her. The life which is within her emerges and becomes independent. In the next case, we see the decay of flesh, which is some sort of death, and also in the case of various discharges or emissions which come out of the body, whether it is sperm which emerges from a man, which is something which a source of life which emerges from him, or a woman who's getting her period, which means that she is not pregnant, that there is a potential for life which has not been realized. In all these cases, the situation contracts impurity. And Rabbi Soloveitchik says the following, and I quote, "Judaism has a negative attitude towards death. A corpse defiles, a grave defiles. A person who has been defiled by a corpse is defiled for 7 days and forbidden to eat any sacred offerings or enter the temple." And he continues, "Many religions view the phenomenon of death as a positive spectacle, sanctify death and the grave because it is here that we find ourselves at the threshold of transcendence, at the portal of the world to come. Death is seen as a window filled with life, a light open to an exalted supernal realm. Judaism, however, proclaims that coming into contact with the dead precipitates defilement. Judaism abhors death, organic decay and dissolution. It bids one to choose life and sanctify it. Authentic Judaism, as reflected in halakhic thought, sees in death a terrifying contradiction to the whole of its life. Death negates the entire magnificent experience of halakha, because when a person dies, he is from the commandment. Halakha is not concerned with transcendent world. The world to come is a tranquil, quiet world that is a wholly good, wholly everlasting, and wholly eternal, where a man may receive the reward for the commandments performed in this world. But the man of halakha prefers the real world to a transcendent existence, because here, in this world, man is given the opportunity to create, act, accomplish, while there in the world to come, he is powerless to change anything at all. The man of halakha longs to bring transcendence down to this valley of shadow of death into our world and transform it into a land of the living. He wishes to purify this world, not to escape from it. His goal is not to flight to another world that is wholly good, but rather bringing down the eternal world into the midst of this world. And therefore, Rabbi Soloveitchik talks about the whole notion that in the world of halakha, we look to raise this world, we look to make this world a better place, we look to alleviate the suffering of those people who are suffering, and holiness needs to keep itself far away from death. This is quite a compelling explanation, and it's quite enlightening, because it really wants to put an amazing focus on Judaism concerned with this world. I've just come out of days of Pesach, where we say, Lo hamitim yahalleluya velo kol yoredei duma. Those people who are dead cannot praise God. Va'anachnu nevarechia, but we praise God. Only when you're alive can tzvot. Only when you're alive can you be engaged in progress and in changing and altering this world, in offering solace to people who are grieving, in offering a helping hand to those people who are stumbling. And in this regard, This world is seen as a world where we can really make a change. The world to come, maybe it's a world of reward and punishment, but it isn't a world where we can really alter anything. And therefore, Rabbi Soloveitchik wants to claim that Judaism celebrates life and abhors death. There's something very attractive about this explanation, but I'd like to take it to a slightly different and explain something about the entire ebb and flow of the book of Vayikra. And I'd like to try and redefine our terms. I started by saying that we have Tumah and Tahara, purity and impurity, sometimes called clean and unclean. And that I said that frequently we look at pure as good and impure as evil. Rabbi Soloveitchik will say, pure is life, impure is death. However, I'm not sure about this, and I'd like to think for a moment about why it matters that something is pure or impure. It's true that certain phenomena in the world of purity and impurity, of Tumah and Tahara, affect regular life. Kashrut would be a good example, Nida would also be an example. But when we read the book of Leviticus, when we read the book of Vayikra, the main emphasis of Tumah and Tahara, of purity and impurity, reflects the world of the temple. Somebody who is pure has access to the temple and everything which is connected, the sanctuary, to the mission. But somebody who is impure is restricted from the mission. And I suddenly began to think about this world of impurity, of Tumah. Because, of course, nowadays, all of us are impure. We don't have a means of purifying ourselves from the impurity which we contract by coming into contact with the dead. And therefore, anybody who has been to a funeral or has been to a graveyard is ritually impure. In fact, so many aspects which are part of regular life make a person impure. As I said, a woman who menstruates becomes impure. A man who ejaculates becomes impure. That means that, you know, any adult man or woman will be in a state of impurity. A woman who has a baby will be pure. A farmer who deals with dead animals, animals which have died, will be impure. In other words, most adults in the world are in a state of impurity and they have no access to the temple until they undergo a process of purification. So suddenly I started thinking about this. Wow, when you want to go to the temple, you have to actually keep away from the farm, time your access for a time in which you are pure. And sometimes I start thinking back to that event of the revelation at Sinai when God revealed his presence to the Jewish people and gave them the Ten Commandments. And he said, men and women keep away from each other for 3 days to achieve a level of purity. The rabbis say that everybody went to the mikveh. And there was a sense of that when you meet the divine, you have to be a sense, hitkatishtem, you have to be in a sense of purity. We do this on a minor level before we engage in in certain ritual acts. The Rambam rules that before a person prays, they should wash their hands. Before a meal, before Birchat HaMazon, some people will wash their hands. This is sort of almost like emulating the ancient world of purity, that when we have a divine encounter, we purify ourselves. But I want to say what that purification is. The purification is saying something very interesting, that when we go to the temple, when we go to the Mikdash, when we go to the Mishkan, we are in fact taking a step out of life. We're taking a step out of the busyness of life, out of our business. You know, later on, when the laws were developed of the temple, we're told that we go into the temple without but we're also not allowed to take our money belt with us. We don't take our wallet. We don't take our credit cards. In today's world, we wouldn't take our cell phone. Because when I want an experience with God, I tread slowly. I don't wear shoes, which are the shoes I wear when I'm walking through the street or where I'm working in the field when I need my feet protected. This is a pristine environment, an ivory tower, where I am meant to have an out-of-life experience. I'm meant to have an experience which is above life. And as such, I leave my regular life, the life of worrying about my children, of childbirth, the life of my sexual relationship. I leave those all behind because I want to have an experience which is out of life, which is above life. I want to encounter God. I want to encounter the divine. And this, and now I want to sort of like recalibrate these words. Tumah doesn't mean impure. Tumah means being involved in the world. When I'm involved in the world, I'm naturally in a world which is caught up in the world of my farm, in the world of my body, in the world of everything. To be tahar, to be pure, means to ready myself to have an encounter with God. And then I go to the center of the camp, or to Jerusalem, where there is a zone which is completely different from life itself. Where there, I want to have a out-of-life encounter with God. where I can leave everything behind. I leave my shoes behind, I leave my cell phone behind, my wallet behind, and I go there to have an undisturbed experience with God. And in order to do this, I go to a different level. And I really think that this is what is happening. And in fact, this is the first half of the book of Leviticus. The first 9 chapters of the book of Vayikra deal with the sacrifice. Hebrew sacrifices aren't called sacrifices, they're called korbanot. Because korbanot come from the word karev. Korbanot are a way of coming closer to God. And in order to do that, you have to become tough. You have to take a step out of life. You have to elevate yourself above ordinary life and to encounter God. And as I said, that's really the only time when I need to become tahor, to encounter God. The rest of the book of Vayikra, if you want, from chapter 8, deals with a different set of words. There the world is going to be kadosh. If you want, kodesh and chol, holy and secular. And there we're going to deal with a world which happens within society. Within society we can have moments of holiness. They're called mikrai kodesh, days which we proclaim as holy. Shabbat and all of the festivals, the holiday, where we create holy time. We can create a holy year, the 7th year, where we desist from working the fields. We're in life. We're within life. We're within the world of agriculture, but we create not just holy time, but holy space. And of course, we can create kadoshim to you. We create holiness within our lives by regulating so many different aspects, the way we relate to the poor, the way we relate in commerce, the way we relate to the disadvantaged society. That will be called kadoshim to you. Chapter 19 of Vayikra. What I think I'm saying is that there are 2 types of holiness in the book of Vayikra. One is a holiness within life, and that is called kadosh. Kadosh and chol. Holy and, if you want, every day. Ordinary and holy. We have ordinary life and we can sanctify our lives when we engage in God's commandments within life. But then there is another whole set of things, and that's a world which we haven't really practiced for 2,000 years. And that's the world of the temple. I have to say that we do experience, or we should experience it a little bit, in the world of the synagogue, in the world of the shul. And the shul is meant to be a mikdash ma'at. It's meant to be a small sanctuary. And that's why, according to the halacha, as I said, when a person enters into the shul, they're meant to wash their hands. They're meant to try and have kavanah, which means directing their minds. They're meant to leave life behind in some way. And therefore, in the Shulchan Aruch rules that a person is not meant to speak with the person sitting next to them in the synagogue. And of course now, our synagogue hasn't only become a Mikdash Ma'ad, it's become a Bet Knesset. It's become a place of meeting in a community center. And I think sometimes when I go to shul, it appears more as a social experience than as a meeting with the divine, because there's an overlap between the Bet Knesset, the place of meeting of the community, with a sense of the Mikdash Ma'at, the small sanctuary. And therefore, sometimes shul becomes a place where people jabber more than they talk to God. They talk to their friends more than they talk to the Ribbono Shel Olam. But if I want to, I will divide up the book of Vayikra in this way. The first half of the book of Vayikra asks us to be a Mamlechet Kohanim, a nation of priests. So said Rav David Zvi Hoffman in his commentary on Vayikra. The aim is to focus around a spiritual hub, the temple. How do we approach God? Through sacrifices. How do we restrict access to this place? By Tumah and Tahara. By purity and impurity. The second half of Vayikra is a whole different story. It deals with how we create sanctity within our lives. It's not about stepping out of life, but how we make life holy. It's about creating holy mannerism. It's about creating holy space. It's about creating a holy lifestyle within life, within the world of commerce, within the world of sexuality, within the world of agriculture, within the world of social interaction, within the world of young people and old people, within the clash of religious practices. And therefore we're warned, for example, not to be involved with idolatry and all sorts of pagan witchcraft and what have you. And in order to create a world of compassion, which is a world of justice, is a world of holiness. And therefore what I've tried, as we're going to be reading the parasha this week, and we're going to amazingly technical stuff about how the main center of our parashiyot is the world of tzara'at, the afflictions of skin, afflictions of the clothing and the house. But this is all a world of tumah and tahara, a world which affects our access. And I've given 2 theories, one of Rav Soloveitchik, that it's about death and it's about decay. That's one theory. But my theory, the theory which I prefer, is actually this is about leaving our life behind The world of Tumah is actually not a bad world at all. It's the world that we all live in. But if we want to have a real divine encounter, or at least one type of divine encounter is finding God in our world. But a different type of divine encounter is to step out of our world, to go to that place of the Mikdash. In order to do that, we need to leave ordinary life behind, the world of sexual relations, the world of childbearing, the world of worrying about the afflictions of our skin and our house. We need to leave the world behind of all of that and step up to a place where we can focus on one thing and one thing only, the world of Tahara, the world of purity, the world of... So what I've tried to do today is to give a specific to Tumah and Tahara, cleanliness and uncleanliness? Maybe not so. Let's just use the Hebrew phrases Tumah, Tahara, and try and think about them behind that. Thank you very much. You all, Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Israel. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.